Well, thank you for agreeing to talk to me again.
For the second time.
I want to start with the background. I want to touch a little bit on your education at Harvard Law School and how that took you to the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Let's see. I graduated from law school in 1958. Went from there to a clerkship with a federal district court judge in New York City, a very distinguished judge, Frederick Van Pelt Bryan, and had a very exciting 2 years with him. We freed Lady Chatterley's lover from a suit by the Postmaster General, and I was privileged to watch and sit in on the trial of Adam Clayton Powell for income tax evasion, who was defended by Edward Bennett Williams, who was then at the height of his career. It was altogether a very instructive and rewarding and interesting assignment. I went from there to a law firm no longer in existence, Greenbaum, Wolf, and Ernst. The name Morris Ernst once meant something, and I think one of the reasons I got that job is because 30 or 40 years before that, Morris Ernst had freed Ulysses from custodian by an earlier postmaster general.
This is intellectual property rights.
Yes, yes. The firm represented a number of authors and publishers. One of the most interesting assignments I had was reading in manuscript, Making of the President, 1960. All books published in New York State are read by counsel, because a bona fide opinion of counsel that the book is not libelous can protect a publisher and author from punitive damages in case of litigation. Although that was very interesting work, it didn't last all that long. Within a year, I found myself totally unexpectedly at the SEC. It started at a New Year's Eve party where a man I knew from the federal courthouse in New York, an assistant U.S. attorney who had prosecuted, together with Irv Pollack, a number of important securities law cases in the 50s, mentioned to me that there was a interesting case being investigated at the SEC, and that it might be worth my while to look into it, because he knew that the commission, and in this case it was Ralph Saul, who was then associate director of the Division of Trading and Exchanges, was looking to hire an attorney to work on the legal, what one might call the legal aspects of the investigation. The investigation turned out to be the case later reported against a prominent American Stock Exchange specialist firm, Ray Ray and Sagarese, who were violating, or accused of violating, the Exchange Act, and while they engaged in specialist activities on the American Stock Exchange. The investigation into their activities had lasted for a long time, and there was a voluminous record. What had to be done was to put the case into a legal framework for briefing purposes and analyzing specialist responsibilities, not only in terms of the Exchange Act, the Securities Exchange Act, but in terms of their common law fiduciary duties as agents for investors. And it was my assignment to research this area and assist Ralph in the preparation of the brief.
So you were putting the Ray case or the charges against the Rays into the context of prevailing law, I guess.
Prevailing law, and looking at the facts which had been developed during the investigation, placing them in the legal context of the governing law. This was somewhat virgin territory. The commission had done little work between 1935 and 1960 on specialists. There were no commission rules directly regulating the conduct of specialists, and the commission had done very little since the 30s in reviewing exchange rules governing the conduct of specialists. I might say that the Ray and Ray proceeding was an administrative proceeding brought internally at the SEC under the securities laws. Such a case is assigned to what used to be called hearing examiners, now called administrative law judges. And a trial, very much like a trial in a courtroom, is conducted. The administrative law judge issues an opinion which can be appealed to the commission and thereafter to a federal court by the losing party. While the case, the Ray and Ray case, was in this framework, it developed in an unusual way. The record, the investigation, had revealed such a multitude of facts which were damning in their amount and qualitatively with respect to the conduct of the Rays. When I say the Rays, I'm speaking of Jerry Ray Sr. and Gerard Ray Jr., his son. And as I may have mentioned, the firm of Ray, Ray & Sagaris were the second largest specialist firm on the Amex at the time. The counsel, a very good lawyer named Milton Gould, who was brought in very late in the case, as I understood it. This all happened before I arrived on the scene. Had prevailed upon his clients, and particularly, I suppose, Jerry Ray Sr., that there was absolutely no way that the commission would exonerate the two of them, but that there might be some possibility that the commission would go more lightly on his son. And so Gould entered into a stipulation with the staff, and that would be, in this case, the Division of Trading and Exchanges, of which Ralph Saul was the associate director and in charge of the investigation, to the effect that the Rays agreed or stipulated to the accuracy of the facts adduced in the investigation, and did not contest that these facts were violations of the securities laws, and reserving only the right to argue with respect to the penalty that would be imposed by the commission. This short-circuited the hearing process so that a hearing examiner who would ordinarily conduct a trial was unnecessary, and the argument ensued was before the commission itself, and only, as I said, involved the penalty to be fashioned. I might mention that at that time there was no enforcement division at the SEC. Enforcement work was done by the various substantive divisions. Thus, the Division of Corporation Finance had what was, I think, called a stop order unit, and that is when a registration statement which was materially defective or possibly fraudulent was filed in connection with an offering of securities, the division's enforcement unit would bring a proceeding, most often an injunctive proceeding, to procure a stop order preventing registration from going forward. Similarly, the Division of Corporate Regulation, which primarily regulated the public utility holding companies, but also regulated the then infant mutual fund industry, had an enforcement unit of its own, and the Division of Trading and Exchanges, the division in which Ralph was associate director, had probably the largest enforcement unit at the SEC, because all broker-dealer wrongdoing came before that division. This could involve everything from capital violations, technical violations by broker-dealers, or abusive selling or fraud in the sale of securities by broker-dealers, whether over-the-counter broker-dealers or exchange members, members of stock exchanges.
So were you in the enforcement group in trading and exchange, or was there such a thing?
No, I wasn't. I, from the beginning, I suppose I had a free-floating job as simply an attorney advisor, I think it was called, in the division, and it was understood that I worked for Ralph Saul. There was no central enforcement unit at the commission. The closest to that was that in the general counsel's office, Irv Pollack, who was an assistant direct an assistant general counsel at the time, coordinated all enforcement work from the viewpoint of making either criminal references in appropriate cases to the Justice Department or brought court proceedings for injunctions primarily to the federal courts for civil violations of the securities laws, which would be handled by the general counsel's office. The regional offices of the SEC also played a role and generally reported to the Division of Trading and Exchanges because most of their enforcement work would involve local broker-dealer misconduct. But IRB would then be involved also in helping shape these cases up from the point of view of either a criminal reference or a court proceeding. So IRB was involved in one way or another with most of the commission's enforcement work, and was involved somewhat in giving aid and support and time to Ralph in the pursuit of the Ray and Ray investigation. There had been, when I arrived, as I said, the investigation was just about complete from a fact-finding point of view, and either a briefing schedule had been already agreed to or was agreed to very shortly thereafter, and the argument then set down for consideration by the commission. However, there had been a fair amount of reaction from Wall Street with respect to the investigation, and a significant amount of political pressure brought on the commission from, you might say, the friends, political friends of people on the street. I know one call that Ralph received, I think, from the Congressman McCormick in Boston, who, if he was not yet Speaker of the House, was an important member of the Congress.
No relation to the McCormick who was heading up the Amex.
No, okay. Not at all. Although I did not know personally of other intervention on the commission level, it seemed clear to me at the time that there had been such attempted intervention because, in particular, Commissioner Gadsby, who had been chairman until the election of Kennedy as president, and who had, under whose administration, the investigation of the Rays had formally commenced, that in observing him at the commission, and particularly during the argument of the Ray and Ray case, it appeared from his body language and bearing that he regarded the powerful case presented by the division as total justification of the investigation, and wanted to make sure everybody in the room heard what was going on. I might mention that it was an unusual situation. Usually when a new president comes into office, the chairman and the political party has changed. The chairman of the various independent regulatory agencies will submit their resignation, clearing the way for the new president to appoint his own chairman. However, when Bill Carey was appointed chairman, there were one or two vacancies on the commission, so that either by pre-arrangement with Bill Carey, which I think was probably the case, Gadsby resigned as chairman of the commission, but did not resign his seat as commissioner, and stayed for several months, winding up his own personal affairs in Washington, and I suspect being of assistance to Bill Carey in the transition from one administration to another. And so that, as I mentioned, Gadsby was an active participant as commissioner during the disposition of the Ray and Ray case.
Was this held in the commission room? Is this the place where they would have done this?
There was a... we're talking now of the old tar paper shack at 2nd and E Street, which had a hearing room. And there was a dais in front where the five commissioners could sit, but very rarely did the commission sit on an enforcement matter as such. And that room was mainly used, I suspect, for hearings with a single hearing examiner, as I said. It was a fascinating building. It was steel construction, partly riveted and partly welded. And it was, I think, three stories high. The commissioners' offices were on the second floor, and every time a truck passed by on 2nd Street, the whole building would bounce up and down, and so you would be discussing a weighty matter with a commissioner, and suddenly the whole room was bouncing up and down. It was clear from the Ray and Ray investigation that we were dealing with the tip of an iceberg, that the corruption extended, had to extend, much further than just the Rays, for a number of reasons. First, many of their activities were just open and notorious on the floor of the exchange. Second, they had stocks assigned to them in which they already had formed close relationships with the management of the companies. And there were just so many of their activities were so aberrant from the point of view of specialist conduct that the exchange could not have been unaware of what was going on, if not the full dimensions of it, but that there was something radically amiss with this operation. So that it was quite clear that the Ray case was only going to be step one in what had to be a second step, and that is an investigation of the American Stock Exchange itself, which the commission is authorized to pursue under the Exchange Act. And no sooner was the Ray case disposed of than the commission entered an order for that investigation. I might say that a couple of interesting observations that I made at that time. One wondered what kind of chairman Bill Carey was going to turn out to be. I had, in trying to decide whether to take the offer of the job at the commission, I really knew very little about the SEC as such. I went to consult my old professor at Harvard Law School, Professor Loss, who was one of the acknowledged securities laws experts in the country. He had written the treatise on securities law. I mentioned that because a friend of mine had said, "Why are you going all the way up to Boston to see Loss? I know a perfectly good law professor at Columbia. His name was Bill Carey, who I had never heard of until he was appointed chairman by President Kennedy." And I kicked myself very hard in the rear end for having missed the possibility of being on the inside track when Bill Carey arrived in Washington. But he was somewhat of an unknown quantity, and his personal bearing was very, very gentlemanly, professorial, and unless you knew that he had, I think, parachuted behind the lines for the OSS and Yugoslavia during the Second World War, you got a very wrong impression of what Bill Carey was like, because beneath that surface, and the surface was real, he was a very thoughtful, man, but there was a backbone of steel. And the first hint we got of that was in the argument of the Ray case, in which Gould was trying to, at his best, to blame everything on the old man, as it were, the old pirate from the from prehistoric times, who really just didn't understand the modern situation, but who agreed that he had violated the law in very significant ways, but that he was the totally dominant figure and his son was just essentially a clerk in the operation. And as Milton Gould was waxing eloquent, Bill Carey leaned forward and in his very soft voice said, "Tell me, Mr. Gould, how old did you say this kid was?" And Gould said, "Well, you know, I didn't characterize him as a kid. That was a witness in the investigation that I was simply quoting. But for the record, he's 38 years old." At which point, Carey leaned back. And I remember Ned Gadsby grinning as that came out. One quick anecdote is that the commission repaired to the commission meeting room after the argument. And because of Gould's stipulations, this what ordinarily would be a separation of functions between the staff and the commission acting in a judicial capacity in a case, that was waived. And so the staff could consult with the commission and the commissioner could consult with the staff on the remedy. And my second, even more direct measure of Bill Carey came when he suddenly asked the director of the SEC Opinion Writing Office, a long-standing position held by Leonard Helfenstein, as to whether the commission could act that day and not wait for an opinion to be written with respect to the remedy to be imposed. And of course there was the talk that this was irregular, etc., etc., and that the better practice would be to wait for an opinion to be drafted by the office. But Carey pressed on, and finally Leonard had to say that no, there was nothing in the law to prohibit this, especially in the circumstances of this case where there was in essence, a full confession on the record, as long as an opinion was written in a reasonable time thereafter. And Carey said, that's very good. That's what I want to hear, because I don't want these two wandering south of Canal Street tomorrow morning. And so the commission expelled two of them from membership on the American Stock Exchange. That afternoon, Milton Gould was in the process of flying back to New York. He was met by some reporters at LaGuardia who asked him about whether he had any comment on the speedy action of the SEC, and they told him what it was, and his comment was, they might have waited till I got back to my office. In any event, the situation then turned to the American Stock Exchange, and discussion at the commission table was in that direction. The staff, Ralph, expressed his concern, and also, since Bill Carey was new, that there would be violent opposition to any investigation, and that there was undoubtedly going to be various forms of political pressure brought on the commission. Bill Carey made it clear that he was not going to be deterred in what he thought was indications of absolutely scandalous and outrageous conduct on the exchange, and gave, I think, the first indication again that he was prepared to fight this publicly, because in his determination to act against the Rays that afternoon, he asked the secretary of the commission, Orville Dubois, who was a single, wore about eight hats as secretary of the commission. He was also their press officer. He typed all the releases himself. Quite a legendary figure in commission history. He asked if anyone knew, directed primarily at Orville, as to when the early edition of the New York Times closed. And there was a discussion at the commission meeting room those of us who may have known, thought we knew, etc. But the general consensus was that it was probably around 7 o'clock. So there was plenty of time to get the commission's action in next day's newspapers. It was also in our minds before the argument at the commission that we were going to, and already had been, subjected to outside pressure, and realized that the whole thing could begin and end with the Ray case, and that there had to be a public reaction to the case in order for the commission realistically to carry forward with an investigation. When I arrived at the commission, there was a reporter who was working on a story. His name was Frank Cormier. He was an AP financial reporter, later chief White House correspondent for AP, who had probably heard about the investigation through sources on the street, because there were dozens and scores of witnesses called in the year or year and a half that the investigation had been pending. As I said before, the stipulation that Milton Gould had entered into also had the effect of making the investigative file a public document. Mm-hmm. So Cormier was busy mining that file, and we were quite surprised when the day before he was supposed to have the story carried on the AP wire, he called Ralph and saw and told him not to look for the story, that it had been killed, that the AP wouldn't run it because he had, of course, asked for comment of the various people mentioned in the story, and that the American Stock Exchange, counsel for the exchange, had threatened the AP with a libel suit. The story was run, and the AP backed away. Another reporter came to our attention, a man by the name of Tom Ottened, O-T-T-E-N-E-D, I think it was, who was, I think, chief Washington correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, who started to work on the story, and I think I told him that to watch out, because somebody had already tried to do this story and had been had the story shot out from under him with the threat of a libel suit. And Tom Ottened said to me that you've got to remember that the Post-Dispatch is old Pulitzer newspaper, and we still have the crusading spirit out in St. Louis. And I was therefore surprised when, after he worked on the story for about a week, to receive a call from him saying, and I will quote to the best of my recollection, "I am nonplussed, shocked, and chagrined, but the paper refuses to carry the story that we've been a threat of a libel suit against the newspaper if we go forward." Thereafter, through some mutual acquaintances, Tony Lewis of the Times became interested in the story of what had happened. He was not a financial reporter, of course, but he brought the story to the financial desk in the Times, and more importantly, as I understood later, he also brought the story to Clifton Daniel, who was, I think, managing editor of the Times at that point. And Daniel personally assigned a reporter, Bob Bedingfield, to the matter. One morning, a receptionist called back and said, a man by the name of Bob Bedingfield here to see you. He's a reporter for the New York Times. Bedingfield was somewhat disoriented because he had been awakened at 2 in the morning by Daniel, who told him to go down to Washington. That was an interesting story. Bedingfield, being a long-term financial reporter in New York, was fully acquainted with all the names, all the local celebs that had been involved in the case, because Jerry Ray was very, he was a glad hander, and in the nightclub circuit in New York, he would say, you know, I'm going to put you in for 500, I have this thing going, I'd get you 1,000 shares, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so there were a fair number of New Yorkers, some of whom seemed really that they had stepped out of a Damon Runyon story, involved in this case. So Bob Bedingfield was very excited about it. And to cut it short, the day before his story was to run, he called and said that the Times had been threatened with a lawsuit, and it was doubtful as to whether they were going to run the story, that it was in the hands of their counsel, Lord, the day and the Lord, and they were taking a very dim view of this. It occurred to me that our brief to the commission was just about finished, and we were going to file it in 2 or 3 days. One always waits to the deadline to file, but we were ready. And Ralph, who really had the labor more in writing that brief, really did a masterful job. My contribution was on the legal side, legal analysis. But it occurred to me that my short stint at the law firm did give me some understanding of the law of libel, that if the Times were reporting what was in the brief of the Division of Trading and Exchanges filed with the commission, that this would provide some legal legal buffer, legal insulation against the libel suit, and particularly would give comfort to the lawyers for the Times, who weren't faced with file cabinets full of documents that said God knows what, but if they could measure this against the contents of a brief, they might be satisfied. And that's exactly what happened. We received word that the story was going to run the next day, and then we received the story, a call that it wasn't going to run because the Times printers had gone out on strike that afternoon, and there might not be an edition the next day, and Then we received the call that the printer's strike had been settled, and a very long story did run on Friday, April 28th, 1961. And if you read the story, you'll see that it expressly relies on the brief of the division.
It makes clear that it's doing that, I guess.
Yes. Expressly said that. So that's sort of the backstairs history of how the Ray and Ray case came to public attention.
So the idea here was to build some support for the idea for going after Amex.
For making certain that the investigation would not be interfered with.
And it worked.
It worked. You see, I'm holding up to you a headline in the New York Mirror. And if you notice, it's the kind of headline that I remember from the Second World War, Germans approach Moscow kind of.
That's the third page.
It says, probe American Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
And then the next line is, SEC acts after Ray scandal. So you can see the Ray case by that time had really passed into public, had it passed into the public consciousness.
So they put together a team to look into Amex in general, do an investigation.
Yes, of the whole exchange. It rapidly became very clear that, as we had suspected, that it was only the tip. Ray case was only the tip of an iceberg. I think as important as the Amex investigation was and the Ray case was, in terms of integrity of the markets, it also revealed that the commission, for a long time, had been asleep at the switch with respect to its regulatory functions under the Exchange Act and its responsibilities for supervising the stock exchanges. I said to you earlier today that it's easy to understand how that happened back then, because in my view it's really happened again at the SEC over the past several decades. The commission is really almost bifurcated in its responsibilities. On the one hand, they're the Securities Act of 1933 is premised on full disclosure. It's a disclosure statute. The Exchange Act, on the other hand, is a regulatory statute that I think there is a much greater public consensus about regulation which is really aimed at transparency and disclosure. Not with George Stigler, the economist, and Henry Manny, the law professor, notwithstanding, on their extreme views of the free market, whether transparent or not, should dominate everything, and that no regulation is the best regulation. I think that those views are really those of outliers on this issue, that there is a general consensus across the spectrum that as a goal, transparency and full disclosure is a good thing. Then one can argue, as we see with Sarbanes, Oxley, and about the details of how one goes about ensuring transparency and disclosure, but no argument about the goal. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when you get to regulatory decision-making, and you're faced with a lot of issues, which you arrived at a conclusion on sort of a 51-49 analysis, and then try to write a regulation that splits the baby that way. It's very difficult. And so you may end up with a kind of black and white resolution of a problem which is somewhat more complex than a black or white issue. And also arouses much greater passion along the political spectrum. The consensus starts to disappear when you start regulating and you run into the free market philosophy, which has really triumphed, I think, in the last several decades. So that the attempt to use the regulatory powers of the independent agencies are bound to arouse much more opposition and a lot more flack than disclosure.
Right. So you need something big to happen in order to regulate to a greater extent than you had before. Thus, something like AMX, like the corporate scandals recently.
Yes, yes, that's about it. That and that once the Second World War intervened between the scandals of Wall Street in 1929 and 1960, memories had somewhat faded. I might say that not wholly faded, that when I was at the SEC in 1960, you've got to remember that in 1960 we were a lot closer to 1929 than we are today to 1960.
Yeah.
That people who were 20 years old in 1929 were just about 50 in 1959-1960. And so that there were a lot of memories of the trials and tribulations of Wall Street. You know, how the shenanigans on Wall Street really fit into the Great Depression. The economists can debate that endlessly, but nevertheless there was a perception, a general perception, that the misbehavior of financial institutions had an awful lot to do with what happened in the country.
Can you talk a little bit about your role in the Amex investigation, what your job was?
Well, we had a number of investigative leads arising directly out of the Ray case, so it was a lot of it was just pulling the strings, as it were, and seeing what came out. I don't want to paint a picture totally black. There were people on the American Stock Exchange who were very disturbed about what was the misconduct of exchange officials, and the floor members of the Amex. But the Amex, and to a certain extent the New York Stock Exchange, the fact that it was called the American Stock Exchange or called the New York Stock Exchange concealed the fact that there was really a whole bunch of different markets on the exchange, that the specialists who might act as specialists in 40 or 50 or 60 stocks each ran their own operation and their market making activities in, to some extent, in disregard of what the overall rules might be of the exchange. It really looked upon the exchange as being a landlord rather than someone who had any supervisory jurisdiction over them. So what we did was simply, on one level, replicate the Ray and Ray case by investigating the activities of the largest specialist organization on the exchange, a company called Gilligan, Will and Company. I also mentioned to you earlier today that, in a sense, the activities of Gilligan Will were already known to the Commission because in the late 50s, the group, the specialist group, had been involved in the distribution of securities on behalf of certain insiders of one of the companies in which they specialized, which excited a lot of attention at the Commission under the Securities Act as to whether the securities had to be registered or not. And there was a good deal of argument and back and forth, and finally the Commission decided that, that the distribution was in violation of the Securities Act and essentially slapped them on the wrist and told them to go and sin no more.
But that being an example of going at, after somebody under the 33 Act rather than the 34.
And not seeing that the major wrongdoing that these fellows were engaged in were was market manipulation and corruption of the marketplace itself, and that the 33 Act violations on their part were purely secondary. So that what we did, and I was involved in this, Ralph directly, a lead investigator of the Commission, Ada Yeagerman, a man by the name of Tim Callahan, and Ira Pierce, who had done a lot of the investigatory work in the Ray case, and who had a nose for wrongdoing. He could almost smell it. We just started with all the whole bunch of the companies that Gilligan was specialist for, which looked like they were shaky, not well known, which looked like promotions, and started looking into that and found a pattern that the one case that the Commission had uncovered about distribution of securities on behalf of insiders without registering those securities under the 33 Act was a pattern, that an established pattern. It was a service that Gilligan Will provided for corporate insiders. And that so we took lots and lots of testimony of these corporate insiders who pretty much told it like it was. It was, we took the testimony usually at the New York office of the SEC, and it was wonderful. We would schedule some witnesses, very often two witnesses almost back to back, not involved in the same company, might involve a different company. And yet, as these fellows we observed would meet each other in the anteroom, waiting, It would be like old home week with some of these guys and telling each other their war stories and all the rest of it. And it turned out, again, just anecdotally, that a lot of these deals that were made at the Oak Room at the Plaza Hotel. That seemed to be a favorite watering hole of people at the Razors, balancing themselves on the Razors' edge in New York low finance. We then turned to the more serious business of what was going on at the administration of the exchange. And here it turned out that there was involvement one way or another at the highest level of the exchange. And it also turned out that the chairman of the exchange had a number of gambling debts paid for him by a well-known convicted securities felon.
That led to a reorganization?
That led to reorganization. I think the way Ralph handled it, here we had developed this record. Then what do you do with it? You can throw the room, the doers off the exchange. You can put the really bad guys in jail. But that left you with a problem. What Ralph did was set up a series of meetings in which he called some of the principals of the largest Wall Street firms down for some heart-to-heart talks about what was coming. And
let me switch tapes here. Yeah.
This led to the appointment on Wall Street of a committee under Gus Levy, then I think senior partner of, I believe it was Goldman Sachs, do a study of problems on the American Stock Exchange. And that committee pretty much cleaned house at the exchange and brought in Ted Etherington, who had been a partner of Pershing at Pershing and Company, as new chairman, president of the exchange. And he was a very bright, vigorous man who career never saw its full fruition because he developed some heart difficulties and really had to retire after several years from active life. Became president of Wesleyan College in Connecticut for a while, passed away about 10 years later. But in any event, he was in prime condition when he became head of the Amex and pretty much cleaned house from top to bottom.
So the Amex investigation, would you say that it really was a precondition for the special study?
Yes, because as the Amex investigation got started, There were a lot of inquiries from the press and from the Hill as to what was going on at the SEC. How could these conditions, as set forth in the Ray case, and what was coming out about the dribbling out about the Amex because the reporters, the financial press, was hot onto it. Did it show the need for a broader investigation of Wall Street and perhaps the SEC itself? And two congressmen in particular, Orrin Harris, chairman of the Interstate and Foreign Commerce Commission, Interstate and Foreign Commerce Committee,
right,
and Peter Mack, chairman of the Security Subcommittee, thought it would be just a terrific idea to run a public investigation of Wall Street and the SEC.
Wow.
It was, I think, one of both of these gents who had been involved in the investigation of the FCC a year or two before, whose main activities were aimed against the quiz shows.
Oh, yeah.
Much to the chagrin of Sam Rayburn, who had wanted a dispassionate look of how the Alphabet New Deal agencies were functioning. And what he got was a sideshow on Charlie Van Doren, shenanigans of fixing quiz shows. The commission, and Bill Carey, of course, was aware of the fact that they might be faced with a congressional investigation, which would not have been really productive. And, you know, in Washington, it's almost, dealing with political issues like this, it's almost like quantum mechanics. You press over here and then something happens over there and you don't know what the connection was. So I don't know, I can't pretend to know how this was diverted from a congressional circus to the special study. I suspect that Bill Carey was making strong representations both up on the Hill and perhaps to the White House. I know what I was doing is that I did know someone who worked for Congressman Bowling of Missouri, who at that time was Sam Rayburn's fair-haired boy, and it looked like he was going to be Sam Rayburn's successor as Speaker of the House someday. And I was able to get to him through the good offices of a classmate. I do know that I believe that's how Sam Rayburn was alerted to the fact that he was going to be possibly faced with another circus. And he essentially, as I understand it, told Harris and Mack to get out of it the best way they could, and probably the best way they could was to authorize, because the matters were so technical that it called for a more technical investigation than the Congress could offer. Therefore, that was the genesis of the special study.
So it goes to the SEC to do the study itself?
Yes, with a sort of a divided... It was very interesting the way it worked out, that the study was of the SEC, but not not the SEC. That Milton Cohn took the job, and the legislative history indicated that Milton Cohn took the job on the understanding that he would not, he was free to go wherever he wanted in the investigation, and that let the chips fall where they may, and that while he would keep the commission acquainted with the progress of the investigation and acquainted with what the study was going to do, that nevertheless he did not need commission clearance to arrive at any particular conclusions.